time is 11 o'clock exactly. Judging a quick count around the room, we do have a quorum present. The record will show that the meeting started at 11 o'clock. The date is Thursday, January 30th, in the year 2003. Taking a roll call around the table, we see Representative Hines, Representative Coghill, Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Kapsner, Representative Sisma, and myself, Representative Gatto. Just first off, I'd like to start with some housekeeping. If you have a cell phone on you or anything that makes noise and sings Star Spangled Banner or Battle Hymn of the Republic, this is the time to disable it. If it goes off during the meeting, then the phone is forfeited to the chair.
Ooh.
For a very long time. You will find copies of the entire packet on the outside tables. I need to remind people that the materials are provided through the courtesy of the chair, and if the materials are brought to the meeting, will be available the following morning, the morning following the meeting. Material requests may be directed to the committee aides, who's sitting at my right, Cody Rice. If you have material for inclusion in packets, they must be submitted 48 hours prior to the meeting. It's very difficult to stay on task when materials are brought in between that 48 hours and the time of the meeting. This is a joint meeting between the HES Committee and the Special Committee on Education. On my left is the chairman of the HES Committee, Representative Wilson, and I am the chair of the Special Committee on Education. The subject today is the No Child Left Behind. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Stevens has also arrived. If you'd like to sit at the table, if we have room, you're certainly welcome to. It's No Child Left Behind, is often abbreviated NCLB. Sometimes it's called ESEA for the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Just a short warning, we'll probably be hear the comment of the adequate yearly progress, maybe many times, because that is a very crucial point in the entire discussion of the No Child Left Behind. Included in the packets are overviews with several sections of the No Child Left Behind and copies of material distributed by the Department of Education. This is an overview by Mr. Ken Meyer, legislative liaison to state elected officials from the U.S. Department of Education. Very powerful group. We have 2 hours here. Can you tell me about how long? Do you need the whole 2 hours to speak?
No, Mr. Chairman. Actually, my PowerPoint presentation will be about 20 to 25 minutes, and then we could do some Q&A after that. So we'll leave it
okay.
up to you.
Okay, that's wonderful. Would you like to finish the entire presentation or have questions as we go along?
I'll leave that up to the will of the committee. I can do it either way.
I think if it's that brief, we would just go straight through and take some notes if you have some specific questions. Note, we are teleconference today, and we have a statewide listen-only audience, so we will not be receiving any questions from legislative information offices or things like that. And I understand Representative McGuire is also present, and if you would like to join us at the table, we would be honored. There is a seat very close here. With that, Mr. Meyer, you may commence.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and visitors. Let me give you a little bit more of a background, give you an understanding why I'm here and what my role actually is. First of all, I'm from the state of Tennessee, where I am a former legislator, so I understand the legislative process from your standpoint. I was brought into the administration just a few months ago, basically to be the liaison to legislators across the country relative to issues specific to No Child Left Behind. While I was in the Tennessee legislature, I was involved with education reform issues fairly deeply. And so I have a fairly good background of knowledge just from that standpoint, although that was 10 years ago. And on a side note, I will say I'm from southeast Tennessee, where we're kind of proud of our little hills, but let me tell you, this place is unbelievable. So, with that, I do bring greetings from the Secretary Page, and we'll get right into this. Basically, what I'm going to do today is give you a general overview of No Child Left Behind. It will probably be repetitive for some of you because it is a general overview, and what I want to do is sort of make sure we're all singing off the same song sheet. And we'll give you an overview. I've got a few slides which deal with some of the, what I want to say, misunderstanding and misinformation that's sort of floating around the country relative to No Child Left Behind. And then we can get into some Q&A and get into some other areas, what's going on throughout the country and that kind of thing. No Child Left Behind, as we all know from the president, is historic reforms which will improve our public schools by creating an environment where every child can learn, and that's part of the battle is making some people recognize the fact that every child can learn, and that's really the premise of No Child Left Behind. It gives unprecedented flexibility for states and school districts, greater local control, more options for parents, and more funding for what works. The guiding principles of No Child Left Behind are very simple: accountability for student performance, focus on what works, reduce bureaucracy, and increase flexibility, and to empower parents. The No Child Left Behind Act calls for annual testing of all public school students in reading and math, grades 3 through 8, and high school by the year 05-06 school year, annual report cards on school performance for parents, voters, and taxpayers, so information is going to be readily available for every stakeholder in this process, which essentially is everyone, ensuring that every child reads by the third grade, and a highly qualified teacher in every public classroom by the year school year 05. Standards, assessments, and accountability. Accountability is an exercise in hope. When we raise academic standards, children raise their academic sights. I don't have the details on this, but Secretary Page gave a talk a few weeks ago in which he made a comment about a study that was done recently where they took a classroom of children and basically picked out just a few children in that class and told the teachers that these are high-performing children. Those children were not high-performing up to that point, but over the course of the year, their teachers expected them to be high-performing children. Those children became high-performing children. It is raising the expectation of education, and that's what accountability is all about. How the No Child Left Behind accountability system works. The states design and implement annual tests in reading and math in grades 3 through 8 and in high school. Federal government provides states with annual funding to design and implement tests, $387 million appropriated for FY02, a 35% increase in federal funds to help states and local schools train, recruit, and retain high-quality teachers, and federal funding for reading instruction is tripled from $300 million last year to $900 million this year, and the request for this next fiscal year is higher than that. Standards. The challenge, obviously, is to establish clear expectations for schools, teachers, and students of what students should know and be able to do. The solution, to require each state to establish its own standards in the core content areas of reading, math, and science. This is very important to emphasize that the states create their own standards. This is not a federally standardized program. Why test? If we don't test, we do not know when children are falling behind. And if we don't test every year, a child can lose a year or more of precious time that can't be replaced. Follow-up to that is, there have been several studies done on this. If a child loses 1 year, there's a compounding effect. That child very seldom has the opportunity to get caught back up if he loses 1 year. We simply cannot afford to do that. This is a map of the states, including Alaska, where the testing is already in place from grades 3 through 8. And I will say Alaska is farther ahead of the curve, and you've done a good job than a lot of states, and you've got a lot to be proud of. Adequate yearly progress. The goal is 100% proficiency for all students, and very simply, why 100%? Because anything less means that children will be left behind. Understand the underlying philosophy behind No Child Left Behind is the focus on the children and not the system. The system obviously is an integral part of the process, but the children are the most important part, and that's why 100% is the goal. What if a school fails to make AYP? For the first time, parents, voters, and taxpayers will know when schools are not getting the job done. Schools in need of improvement will receive extra help. students in need, students in chronically lower performing schools will have escape routes, and schools that continue to be low performing after receiving extra help may be reformed by the state. That is an option. Parental options. Testing empowers parents with information, but parents must be able to do something with that data if failing schools does not improve. NCLB provides a safety valve for students trapped in chronically failing or dangerous schools. Parents of students in Title I schools identified for school improvement, corrective action, or restructuring will have the option to transfer to another public school in the district, not in school improvement. Parents of students in Title I schools identified for second year of school improvement, corrective action, or restructuring will be eligible to receive supplemental services for their children. And to focus on what works, scientifically based research. The problem we've had in education throughout this country is we've had some really very good schools throughout the country, and we've had some lower performing schools throughout the country. But there's never been a comprehensive way to study what teaching methods actually work and what schools are doing a good job and how we can duplicate or replicate those systems across the country or across the state in whatever the case may be. And that's what scientifically based research is all about, is taking the approach of gathering information, identifying where the strengths are, replicating those programs, and also doing away with those programs that are not being effective. The president is very strong and very supportive on this whole process, and his position is the most basic educational skill is reading, and the most basic obligation of any school is to teach reading. His Reading First program is a very integral part of No Child Left Behind. The basic premises are all but a very small number of children can be taught to be successful readers. Prevention of reading problems is far more cost-effective and efficient than remediation. Reading failure can be prevented by relying on the extensive scientific research base in reading. How will Reading First help schools and teachers produce successful readers? By focusing on high-quality, comprehensive K-3 reading instruction for all children, by basing instructional decisions on what works basis, and by putting the solid research base on reading into the hands of the teachers, the people that are on the front lines fighting this battle. We're asking a lot of our nation's school teachers, and we continue to ask more. America is facing a growing shortage of qualified teachers, 2.2 million in the next 10 years. Teachers should be treated and supported like the professionals that they really are, and they need the tools to work with. A highly qualified teacher in every classroom, and I'll get to the definition of that in just a moment, but beginning with the first day of 02-03 this school year, new teachers hired to teach in Title I supported programs must be highly qualified. The state must have a plan for achieving annual increases in the percentage of highly qualified teachers to ensure that all teachers of core academic subjects are highly qualified by 05-06. What is a highly qualified teacher? In the elementary school, the teacher holds a bachelor's degree and has demonstrated mastery by passing a rigorous test in reading, writing, math, and other areas of the curriculum. In middle or high school, holds a bachelor's degree, has demonstrated competency in subject area taught by passing a rigorous state test or through completion of an academic major, graduate degree, or comparable coursework. Fortunately, most teachers meet this standard, and that's been, a very important part, but most teachers, through certification and other means, are already there. Good teachers make lifelong differences. To help states and local school districts place highly qualified teachers in every classroom, the No Child Left Behind Act provides 35% increase in federal funds to help states and local schools train, recruit, and retain high-quality teachers. Retention is becoming more of a focus. Let local school districts use federal funds to improve teacher training, reduce class sizes, and increase teacher pay. Flexibility and local control. No Child Left Behind actually puts in a tremendous amount of local control and flexibility into the process, and there's some controversy about that, and we'll get into that. How it works. Local school districts can make spending decisions for up to 50% of their non-Title I federal funding. Flexibility applies to non-Title I federal funds, including teacher quality, technology, after-school learning, and safe and drug-free schools. For an example, if a local school district prefers to use 50% of its federal technology funds for recruiting quality teachers instead of technology, it can do so. In addition, up to 150 local school districts nationwide can participate in a local flex pilot project to make spending decisions for 100% of their non-Title I federal funds. One story I like to relate, when I was in the Tennessee legislature, I did visit one local school district, and I don't know if you've had this problem here, but a lot of money was set aside for technology. Well, it could only be spent in one way in this particular situation, and that was to buy hardware. So I walked into a warehouse for the local school district, and they had lots of technology, and it was in boxes, literally probably hundreds of computers sitting in boxes because there was not enough funding at that time to provide training. And so this basically would provide the flexibility to shift funds around as necessary. Supporting technology, more than $700 million is for states and schools in O2 through the Enhancing Education Through Technology program. Those numbers have increased, but I don't have the current numbers. I apologize. The flexibility provisions allow states and schools to use more of the federal funds to make better use of technology, consolidate and use funds for any educational purpose permitted under the ESA, the four programs. And the E-Rate initiative is at $2.25 billion. So technology is a very critical part of NCLB. To support education reform, President Bush and Congress have provided a dramatic increase in Title I aid to local schools from $8.6 billion in 2002 to $10.4 billion in 2003, and that number will increase again this year. Provided a 35% increase in teacher quality aid to states and local schools and tripled funding for reading programs. Also provide support for 1,800 new and existing charter schools, increased special education funding, IDEA, by $1.3 billion. This sort of summarizes NCLB from an overall perspective. The academic achievement gap must be closed, and truly this is, and the President is very passionate about this, and Secretary Page is carrying out an implementation of this program because it is vital to the future of our economic future of our country and for our basic security. Some myths and realities. These are some of the things that we've picked up basically across the country about what NCLB is and what it is not. First of all, the first myth that we've run across, or not the first, but one of them, is the Act contains unfunded mandates. Well, first of all, since 1995, Congress has been expressly prohibited from passing any legislation that contains unfunded mandates. NCLB was passed also with large bipartisan support. So there is not an unfunded mandate in place. NCLB will diminish local control. The reality is, under NCLB, every school district and local administrator in America will now have greater flexibility to spend federal funds on local priorities and initiatives than they've ever had before. The next myth is NCLB Act will dictate what is taught in America's classrooms, and this is absolutely false. Not only does NCLB expand flexibility for school districts to spend federal funds on local priorities, the law specifically states that the federal government cannot mandate, direct, or control a state or school district's specific instructional content, academic standards and assessments, curricula, program, or instruction. NCLB does not provide enough funds for implementation, the next myth. NCLB provides historic increases in K-12 funding. States receive approximately 21% increase in overall K-12 federal funding. The bulk is in Title I and Title II programs and technology and assessment programs. Title I grants to states and local districts increased by $1.6 billion first year, approximately 18%, and Title II grants for teacher funds increased by 35%. Again, these numbers are a little bit out of date because that was first year, but those numbers are higher now. The next myth, third through eighth grade testing is an unfunded mandate. Again, this is false. Congress has already agreed to pay for the new assessments. Congress included legislative language that stipulates that states are not obligated to administer the new tests unless federal funds are appropriated to cover the cost of the test. NCLB only goes into effect if the funds are provided. Under NCLB, many states will be receiving actually more money from the federal government to design and administer tests than they currently spend on tests they already administered. And I don't know if you've done an analysis on what your state spends, but that's obviously and it would be something to look at here. Next myth is that NCLB Act contains new teacher requirements which were an unfunded mandate. Now, this is false. NCLB does require that all teachers teaching core curriculum subjects be highly qualified. The definition merely requires that teachers demonstrate subject mastery through state licensing or subject testing or by possessing a major or minor in the subject. This is a relatively low-cost item because most teachers already do meet the criteria for being highly qualified through certification programs. Overall, states have received a 35% increase in teacher funds. Next myth is that annual assessment requirements of NCLB override local curricula or instructional practices. Now, many states have already administered assessments which have not led to statewide curriculum, and in Alaska certainly you probably have experience with this as well. And clearly, statewide assessments do not mean a statewide curriculum must follow. NCLB does not dictate local curriculum. Where are we today? Well, January 8th marked the one-year anniversary of the President's signing of the No Child Left Behind Act. January 31st, tomorrow, marks the deadline for states to submit plans for approval by the U.S. Department of Education. So far, five states with diverse plans have taken a lead and have been approved prior to the deadline. One comment I will make about this, and those states that have been approved, Colorado, Indiana, Massachusetts, New York, and Ohio, I had the opportunity to sit in on some of the meetings and somewhat familiar with some of their plans. All five of these plans are very diverse. This is not a cookie-cutter approach. The Secretary and Undersecretary are working very diligently with the states to address specific and unique problems that each state has. And so the states, which is really cool about this program, is the innovation and outside the box type of thinking that we're beginning to see relative to some of these plans that are coming in. 20 states have received, actually it's more than that now, it's at least 21 and maybe more. I know Virginia received a grant a couple of weeks ago, but as you can see, 20 states have received Reading First grants for a total of $412 million. Virginia received, I think, $16 million, so we'd add to that, and there may be some others since then.
Mr. Meyer, just a question. How much
I'm finished
longer?
Anyway.
Are you? Okay. Well, you're pretty close to your time if you are finished.
Sure. That is it.
Well, congratulations on being only 3 minutes off of your allotment. But I will say you talk very quickly.
Well, and
rapidly, I should
right.
say. And it was difficult for me, and I'm sure others, to write the questions down and not be already on to the next phase.
Okay.
But I've watched some people accumulating some questions, so I think
sure.
this would be a good time for questions and answers.
Let me say one thing as well. I'm not a technician, so I will not get into the minutiae of the law. But I am a liaison, and I can be your conduit to find out the answers to the questions.
Okay, fair enough. But just some housekeeping. I noticed Senator Betty Davis showed up during the delivery, and just for the record, that she is also present. So, with that in mind, someone want to volunteer the first question?
I have one.
No, Representative Guerra was up first for me.
Thank you to the chair. I have two questions. And one of them might be answered much more quickly, so I'll ask that first one. You gave a presentation on unfunded mandates and showed where the mandates were not unfunded, in fact. But when you got to the point of addressing the requirement that schools constantly assess the progress of children and constantly assess the progress within their districts, there was no mention of funding to help the schools do the assessments. But was that just missing from the presentation? Is there money that's dedicated?
Yes.
There
yes.
is money that's
yes.
dedicated
yes.
to assessment.
Right, right.
And is that the same, is the rule the same there, that as long as that the states can only be required to do the assessments to the extent the assessment money is granted, and if assessments cost more than is made available under No Child Left Behind, then states aren't obligated to continue the assessments?
If it can be demonstrated that is the case, but I think you will find, as many states have found, that the money is there and it is adequate.
Money dedicated just for assessments.
Right.
Wonderful. And then the other question is, it might take a little longer to answer, and you might want to answer this for me maybe after the meeting if it's going to take too long. Prior to No Child Left Behind under Title I, money was made available for class size reduction on the federal level. Can you compare for us the amount of money that was made available before this law and the amount of money that will be made available now for class size reduction?
It varies from state to state. And I do not have the numbers, the total numbers off the top of my head. I will have to research that and get you the numbers. But it does vary. I mean, each state is different. So I just have to do some research on that.
But if class size reduction is a priority for a state, will there be as much federal money, at least as much money available to states to reduce class sizes as before, or has money been shifted away from class size reduction to some of the other priorities of the No Child Left Behind?
I don't want to give you the wrong answer, so I will find out for sure. It's my understanding that you would not be precluded from using those federal funds for class size reduction.
Thank you, Representative. Next, Senator Davis.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern is about IDEA. You did speak to that.
Right.
You said there was a sum of money that was increased in the present budget.
Right.
This is budget. What was the percentage, and what is the proposed percentage to be added? You have not reached the 40% that the feds have said that they were going to give. What is the percentage?
I do not know that, but I will find out.
Thank you very much.
If you will. And one thing I will say, my email address and my telephone number are here. And please, and that's going to be, as we go through this, please send me emails with specific questions, and I will get the answers.
Thank you, Senator Davis. Representative Kapsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meyer, you briefly touched on the myth that NCLB does not provide enough funds for implementation, and then you went on to describe that Title I grants to states and local districts increased by nearly $1.6 billion and are going to increase again. My question is, are those grants to Title I eligible schools, are they competitive, and are they recurring annually?
They are recurring, yes. Are they competitive between states?
Do people have to apply for them and then only a certain percent are awarded those grants? That's what I mean by competitive.
Well, no, they're not. It comes in, this is where it comes into how your state, your plan for the state, basically. It does get rolled into your state plan, which will be addressed through your state school chief and the governor. And so it's not competitive per se, because it's all part of a bigger package.
Now, can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
So what you're saying is the state is the pass-through agency. The districts themselves don't get the money directly.
That's through the state, right.
Okay, and another question I had, I just want to follow up and make sure that this is kind of like a raise and not just a bonus. This is recurring.
Yes.
Schools can count on this. Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kapsner. Vice Chair, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, and Ed might have to answer some of this a little bit. I don't know. It says here that 50% of the non-Title I federal funding, there's flexibility, and that they, and in our schools, whether they're rural schools or urban schools, I think there's probably a disproportionate amount of Title I, of non-Title I funds. And I'm wondering how that's going to pan out in some of the areas, especially when we have areas where there's, like in a school, there's only two teachers,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to have to make sure that they're qualified in every area that they teach. But in a lot of our schools, especially the Bush schools, we have maybe two teachers that teach every grade. And so how are they going to be qualified to do all? I mean, they've been doing it for a while, but are we expecting them to take their own money to get the extra schooling that they need for this, or are we going to? Is there going to be money from the feds to help them do that?
There is money. That 35% increase that I mentioned addresses additional training for teachers. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, and now Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. That was a good presentation. In empowering the parents, you talk about parents of students in Title I schools have the opportunity to transfer that child to another public school.
Right.
I live in a district that is growing by leaps and bounds. My schools are already way overcrowded. Sand Lake, Bayshore, there's no room for anybody to go anywhere. And so I have confidence that they will probably be successful schools, and I think that there might be even people that would want to transfer their kids to those schools. And my question is, how do you envision that working? If a parent is taking that choice to transfer that child to another school that's already overcrowded, has there been any thought about how that's going to play out?
There is, and again, that should be addressed there is no specific federal guideline how that will work. Each state is approaching it differently. Capacity is, it's interesting in dealing with a lot of different states, as I have been over the last few months. Some states are approaching it different than others. Some are saying, okay, we've got some older schools here, we can create schools within schools. I mean, if you've got actual physical capacity problems, then there's going to have to be some room's going to have to be found somewhere. But there's some innovative thinking taking place across the country in terms of how that could be how that could be addressed. It doesn't necessarily. A couple states or a few legislators I've talked with have even brought up the idea of vacant buildings that are in their area for some overflow and there's some real outside the box kind of thinking that's taking place.
Okay. We've got a lot of modular. Through the chair, we have a lot of modular furniture, buildings in my district, and we've been paving over hockey rinks and all kinds of different things to try to do that, but there's only so far you can go. So, and then my final question is, you talk about failing schools, and you say that schools that continue to fail after receiving extra help may be reformed by the state. And I recognize
an option.
And I recognize that that's something that we'll have to deal with perhaps if it occurs. But I think it's a serious problem for Alaska, and I think that it may be a serious reality. And it's something that we talk about all the time. We've talked about it even when we started implementing the exit exam. Schools that are going to be identified as failing, we're going to help them with grants and so on and so forth. But what if you continue providing those grants and you ultimately see that it's not going to succeed? It's a state problem, but I'm wondering if there's been discussion about how that might proceed or if you've had other states that have dealt with that. I think it's a serious problem. It's a very delicate issue. We have a lot of urban and rural issues that we face in the state of Alaska, and I don't think anyone wants to see a situation where the state is taking over a school.
Oh, I agree. And obviously every state is dealing with that challenge. And again, every state is dealing with it differently. There's fear involved. I mean, you don't want to go down that road, and so it creates a lot of pressure. And I hate to keep using this term, but there's a lot of it creates more pressure for non-conventional type of thinking in terms of how we address that. Obviously, that would probably be a last ditch type of situation because a lot of steps could be taken before you get to that point. But ultimately, what it comes down to is this, and this is the president's priority. The children are what's most important. They've got to be educated. And so there's got to be out-of-the-box thinking if that's what it takes.
Normally, we go around the table and give everyone one chance before a person gets a repeat question, but Representative Kapsner has a question on this same issue, so I'm going to allow her an additional question here.
I appreciate that. Representative McGuire brought up a lot of the same concerns that I have, as do administrators in my district. One of the things that concerns me is that the punitive actions that, after a school is identified for school improvement, corrective action, or restructuring, have the option to transfer. I'm from Western Alaska. I represent 30 small villages and one hub community. We don't have roads that link any of those communities together. Everything is done by air travel. So I don't really think that transferring within the district to another school, and it may be that because of the lack of English proficient children that we have in my district, all of my schools could be failing within the district. So that's not really an option for us in terms of transferring elementary age students. And some of the corrective actions that I see and see... And what is the acronym?
NCLB.
NCLB enacting as entire staff replaced.
Right.
One of our concerns is that we have such low teacher retention as it is. Most of the time in a lot of our villages, it's 100% staff change every year anyway. Whole new curriculum implemented. charter status for the schools, a change in administration, or outside consultants brought in. I don't really see any of these as being corrective measures, and I was wondering if you could address that.
I cannot really specifically because I know that there has been correspondence between your state school chief and the governor and the secretary, Secretary Page and Undersecretary Hickok. Those concerns are not unique. They are unique in a way to Alaska because it's so broad, obviously, but there are other states that have similar concerns. And so that issue is being considered. I do not know what the resolution will be. I know one thing that has been brought up in some of the other states I've dealt with is the whole concept of distance learning, the whole concept of possibly creating a school inside of a school. Obviously, you've got some very, very small schools, and that may or may not be an option. But, again, it's just approaching it from different angles. So I do not have a specific answer for you on that other than to say that I know that there's dialogue taking place.
Thank you. Representative Hines?
Thank you. Enjoying your presentation. Thank you for coming. I noticed that under the empowering of parents, it seems to me that every program that I've ever seen with that had to deal with schools was that the parents were a great part of that success. Is there more in here where the parents are? I mean, what about single parents, latchkey kids, that type thing? Is there any way to reach those kids that don't have the parents right behind them, watching them, if you know, standing behind them and saying, "Gee, you're not doing well in this school. We need to transfer you." Or, I mean, some kids are more lucky, you know, are luckier than others.
There are, but by and large, parents. The underlying philosophy of No Child Left Behind is the fact that most all parents do care for their children. And granted, some are more challenged than others in terms of the resources that they have. But they will be empowered with information. And they will be empowered with options. And if their child is not receiving what they should be receiving in the environment they are in, they do have a choice. Not all parents are going to make the best choice, and that's a risk. But by and large, the concept is for them to be given that opportunity for the choice.
Just to follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, some kids, they're if it's a single parent, they work and they may work two jobs and they literally don't have time, a lot of time, to watch the children. So, is there an instance or some possibility of the teacher also watching where the child doesn't fall through the cracks?
It's up to the state, frankly. I mean, there's not a solution for that driven from the federal government. I mean, if Alaska wants to put in a program that specifically addresses that, you're not precluded from doing that, and it would not be inconsistent with No Child Left Behind because the focus is on the child. The ball basically is in your court to come up with solutions to address those specific problems.
Thank you, Representative Cisna.
And again, welcome to our wonderful state. And our state actually that has been grappling with the changes that it's been going through in growth. And the changes that have had to take place in schools. I represent an area in Anchorage. And the area that I represent has older schools, and to accommodate the size of those schools and the downsizing of the people with young children, what they've done is expand and have been delighted to bring in special groups. There's a program for the deaf. The kids experiencing other kinds of things like social deficits, and those schools are happy to have grown in that way, and in your guiding principles, it would appear as if they would fit into the mandates of this program, accountability and a focus on what works. And reducing bureaucracy and increasing flexibility and
empowering parents. But I guess my concern is, from the very little I've learned, and I'm just learning, but that in fact the accountability for school performance would be a question of who is that accountable to? What population is it? The federal government, the state government, the local, the parents, the community, and they might all have different ways of looking at that, and different things that they want out of it, and what works and what works where. In my community, it might be one school. It would actually be at the school for the socially impaired. Those kids need to learn compassion, and that's exactly what the school has been focused on, and getting better and better and better. I would be very fearful of that school being branded as failing. And I think it'd be horrifying when those kids have learned compassion. We need, as community members, as next-door neighbors of these kids, I need them to be compassionate. Mm-hmm. They're high school students. They may be poor in their reading, but I think, first of all, you want them not to be ill to the people around them. Does this give room for that kind of diversity in school programs? Does it label schools that might, in fact, be a school for a specific purpose which doesn't fit a general category?
Let me answer it this way. I think I understand what your concern is. I was going to make this comment anyway. I think what we're going to see is some very interesting partnerships that will evolve over the next few years with different stakeholders in education. We are all stakeholders in this process. And yes, everyone has a different perspective on the problem and coming at it from a different angle. The example I was going to relate to, or the comment, is it's interesting the general enthusiasm from outside the general education establishment or government or whatever. What I'm talking about is in the corporate community and in the nonprofit community and in those people who terribly want to help education improve. From the business community particularly, we're now seeing picking up on a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of innovative thinking from the standpoint that business people are trained and driven by accountability and results. Prior to NCLB, and this varies from state to state to some extent, but the whole concept of focusing on accountability gives these people who have an interest, who may not have been all that anxious to commit resources to address specific problems before, because it was basically write a check, but it's trust me, or the concept of give me the check and trust me and I'll do the job. Well, now, under NCLB, under the whole concept of accountability and information being made public for everyone, they can now see where money can be spent, and spent well, and spent wisely. So in the context of your question, I think that what we will see is it could be a nonprofit, could be a for-profit, could be, a corporation or whatever, taking on schools or projects specific to particular needs in communities. And I think it's very exciting. I think we're going to see some very interesting partnerships evolve over the next few years to deal with that issue. Now, those children will not be exempt from testing and assessments. That information will still be there. But I think we will see different resources come into the situation that might address the specific needs. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, not quite. As a matter of fact, these schools all have school corporate companies. That program has been going on. There's been some really exciting things that have been going on. And I think that anything that emphasizes that more is good. And I mean, I'd be in favor of that. But they still have to take the testing. This is the way it sounds to me. They still would fit into this general classification of failing in certain areas and have to meet a certain level. And in these programs that are specific, not going to be able to get there. They may never be able to get there, and yet the kids are learning exactly what we need them to learn to the best of their ability. They're trying to come up to a certain level in the indicators in reading and those other things, but they're never going to be able to be 100% proficient because they are. And yet, even in one feel like they're feeling.
You're the one that sits there. Why can they not meet that?
We set a statewide standard, not a school-by-school standard.
Right.
I'm saying school-by-school, they're not going to be able to meet the state standard because they can't. Now, I couldn't even misunderstand exactly what your program really does, but it sounds that might be the problem. And I am really very concerned that none of our children feel like they're failing when they have gone to the very pinnacle of their own personal ability.
I understand your concern. The president made a speech a couple of weeks ago in which he, and this is sort of a hard comment, but the comment was that identifying a problem is not creating a problem. If there are children that or subgroups that are not meeting proficiency, then we've got to come up with other ways to address the problem. The president's position is, and the administration's position is, that all children can learn and can meet proficiency unless they are in special ed programs or specifically identified otherwise. And then they're in a different category.
So they would be exempt from the school being granted as not having come up to a proficiency level if in fact that whole school...
No, they would not be exempt, but if the special ed programs are in a separate category.
Okay. I'm going to be anxious to watch this. I don't probably understand enough, but that question is there, readdress that, and I'd love to do it not in this hearing, but...
Yeah, and again, and I'll reiterate, if you'll send me an email or call me or whatever, and we'll get more in-depth on some of these things, because, my role is to be your conduit to the administration, to the department, to find out some of the specifics.
Thank you very much for that. She asked some very pointed questions that the state... viewing distance of another school if you're on top of a mountain, but there is no way to get there because of rivers and terrain and whatnot. And I think most of us feel that Alaska does have a somewhat of a unique situation. I would bet that every state says the same thing. That,
well,
yes, we in Tennessee are very unique. You are.
Right.
We are too.
Right.
But our uniqueness is very much different, guided by topography and climate and distances and communication and, of all things, culture. We do have different cultures that are very difficult to upheave or penetrate or modify or change or dispose of.
Right.
And yet we are being asked in, not asked, I guess I should say we're being told in the NCLB that we will have certain standards that we have to meet. And you said that, well, it says no child left behind, and you also said that all but a small number of children can be successful readers. We're going to leave some children behind. We are, who are not able to achieve through parental influence, through past failures, through a lack of proper nourishment, through a lack of proper clothing, through a lack of proper peer groups. I mean, we have all sorts of problems. You have them too. I tend to think we have them, more of them, in bigger bunches. And I feel the pain that a lot of the teachers are feeling. Yeah, one teacher schoolhouse, and yet you will be proficient, or we will replace every teacher who's not proficient. What happens? We close the school, we chuck out the teacher, we ask someone to do things they cannot do in any amount of time. They may be educated within their district in Kotzebue. They are not going to be able to go out and get proficient in all the areas that you're asking. And so my concern is that you can say, we got $12 billion this year and more to come. and yet we will not be able to achieve it? And the answer is, fine, we'll go down the road to the next school. Now what happens? There is no down the road to the next school. And if we do that, we have to pull them, go to the next school, we fly them there, and then we take them away from their family, and now we've added another level of difficulty. That's my concern, is that this is a very complex and very expensive program, and even the title, No Child Left Behind, scares the bejesus out of me. I don't think we can do all the things you want us to do. That's the message I want you to take back to Washington, is that it is very difficult and we'll try our darndest, but we cannot do things that are literally impossible. And that's what I feel, and many of us feel we're being asked, is to do something that just can't be done in the time you want us to do it, with the money you've allotted for us, and in the environment that we have to do it. So I'm sorry for going this long. I guess it was my turn to speak. So.
I will carry your message back. But one thing, let me emphasize again, that there is a lot of flexibility. It truly is not a cookie-cutter approach. Granted, you've got some very unique situations here. And the dialogue between your state school chief and the secretary and undersecretary, their offices, hopefully these problems can be addressed.
And I've heard you say it is not a cookie-cutter approach, and I'm not confident that what you're saying is entirely accurate. So bear with me if I just tend to be the doubting Thomas, is that I've looked over this stuff, I've been involved a long enough time to recognize that there are plenty of people in the schools who are scared of this. And they know, just because administration, and especially the D.C. administration, passes information to the state, which passes it to the district, which passes it to the school administrator, which finally passes it to the person who's involved with the student and says, we will do these things. And the answer is, how? Is that answer available to that teacher? Well, we go all the way back up the line till we hit President Bush and say, by the way, we have this question from this school teacher in Fleetmute. And he says, Fleetmute, where's that? Well, we can tell you where it is. But those are the kinds of problems that we have. They can't jump on the telephone even and say, I have a problem. I don't know how to satisfy what you want me to do. However, I will do my darndest to see that these kids get the best possible education. They get the best possible education, but it is only the best possible education. The environment sometimes is very prohibitive, and they work as hard as they can and struggle. They struggle. The kids struggle. And sometimes we can't meet. And I'm worried about, okay, Dad, I can't do this. Well, son, you'll do it or you're out. Well, how many of us treat our kids that way? Our kid is doing as best he can, but he cannot get better than a C. Do we throw them out and send them to Uncle Joe, who happens to be in Washington somewhere? Or do we simply deal with them and say, you're trying as hard as you can, but you can't meet adequate yearly progress, so you're out of here? Well, I'm concerned. And I need you to get that message, that that concern is shared by a great many people. And with that, I'm going to transfer to Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for coming, Mr. Meyer. I was concerned by your opening statement that I tried to get it down. It was something like, if a child loses 1 year, the child either cannot catch up or will never catch up.
Seldom. Right.
If that's what your science says, then the whole idea of annual progress to the preset levels doesn't work. And because if a child loses 1 year and you find the school in, he's lost that year, well, the school is going to be in the system forever because the child isn't going to catch up to that yearly progress. What's that?
Services. It may require extra work. It may require a tutor. It may require means to bring that child back up. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying that in the traditional classroom, if that child loses in that classroom and then goes into next grade and he's in a traditional classroom and is not getting extra help, that child's going to fall farther behind. But if he gets supplemental services because it's been been identified that that child is falling through the cracks, then those supplemental services can come into play. And perhaps a tutor will be necessary, or whatever means that that your plan develops to address that child. Again, the emphasis is on the child.
I guess this leads into my second part of my question, and we have a number of schools that have a focus on a longer-term goal than an annual progress. I could give you an example. The Russian Old Believers in my district, Ketchmak Selo, the kids come in, and for the first 2 years, they are educated 100% in Russian. That's what they're taught in school. And then it goes to 30% English, and then it goes to 70% English. We do basically standardized tests throughout the district now. And the third grade, they're behind. Okay, so annually, they're behind until that point if we do annual assessments, obviously, on reading. By the sixth grade, they're on par with the rest of the Kenai Peninsula District, and Kenai Peninsula District is one of the better performing districts in the state. And by eighth grade, the average is performing above where the district is and above the state. And, you know, there is some thing with cultural dropouts and all this other stuff, because within their culture, these people work and work hard. They're out fishing, whatever, so that at younger ages they tend to fall out of the system. But if you look at this as annual progress, starting from the first, that those are going to be failing schools. You're going to identify them as failing. They are going to fail. And we're going to be replacing all those teachers, and yet...
First year.
Well, not the first year. That's right.
4 or 5 years down the road.
That's right. But where you have a system that looks at a longer-term educational goal so that you have kids coming out in the end knowing two languages, being able to read and write both languages... They have a lot of education, and at the end of the eighth grade, or by sixth grade anyway, these kids are performing about up to level, and by eighth grade, they're above the level. You're going to replace all those teachers long before that, because at the end of the first grade, these kids are not going to be meeting annual progress on English. And the second one, third year, hey, by the time you get up to the upper grades, hey, you've replaced all the teachers in this school. What you have is two different things. We've got more than one school like this. We've got the Chugach model, which also works on a variety of things and a longer educational goal period than 1 year annual yearly progress. And so my concern is that, you know, we've got educational models we're saying that don't work in the United States that focus on tests or focus on annual yearly production instead of a kid's growth over the time he's in school and coming out in the end with good knowledge to be a good citizen and having adequate skills to deal with his environment. And it seems to me that we have to be very careful or mandating that those schools that work on a longer time frame to come out with a child that is very qualified as a citizen, we don't break that up and say, oh, no, you can't use a long-term model, and we can only use a short-term yearly progress model. And so that's my fear, and I'd like you to address that.
Well, and that's a very, very good fear. NCLB is not inconsistent with what you're saying. NCLB is a 12-year plan. But it's simply, but it's not saying that we're going to do a baseline here, and 12 years from now we're going to teach again, or we're going to test again. It basically says we've got a 12-year plan to go down here, and we do expect movement toward that goal, which is consistent with what you're saying. Now there are going to be dips and valleys, and that's going to happen everywhere. But as long as there's consistent progress toward that goal 12 years down the road, we're getting there.
And I agree with consistent progress, but sometimes progress is consistently inconsistent. And I believe what he's saying is that we have a situation. He has Russian schools. We have a school called Beryosova. Russian is their first language, and it's spoken perfectly. And by the time they're in fourth or fifth grade, they're speaking English perfectly. We have kids who have a college degree, the equivalent of a college degree, in our fifth grade. And yet, if we had tested them according to the rules, conceivably we would have had to replace all of their Russian teachers, who are, have Russian as their first language also, I believe, with people who don't speak Russian. And I don't know, I think the point is well made. I'm going to do something at this time. We're exactly halfway through, and I'd like to take a 10-minute recess. It's 12 o'clock. Please be back by 12:10, and we'll take some water and refresh ourselves. Speaker, there have been a couple of times where you commented that you would be getting back to us with information. I would ask that, for us, accountability is very important. Most of us wouldn't survive in this climate if we weren't accountable to each other. We would like you to, you can do either send it just to me with a request to distribute to the people on the who are present, or send it to each one, which would probably be a little more difficult. And if there are members in the audience who also have questions, you may send them to the chair, me, and if when I accumulate them, I will then pass them on to the speaker in Washington, D.C., and once again, we would get all the answers together, and then I would probably work to make them as public as I can. With that, the next person who wanted to speak is not present. In fact, neither of them are present. But so we can move then to Representative Seaton.
I guess I'd like to follow up on what we were talking about before the closure. At school that I was referring to, Ketchmaxilo, you know, they have a different set of educational goals than basically No Child Left Behind does. And how do we arrive at the situation in which they want kids to be proficient in reading and writing Russian by the third grade, and they're not going to be proficient in English in the third grade? They know that. That's part of the educational plan, teaching in their native language to begin with. As I understand it, if we're testing as a third grade, and then the next year we're testing in the third grade, and then the next year we're not testing those same students all the way through. We're testing a new group of students. So how would we structure this so that Ketchmaxilo, which turns out proficient students in the eighth grade,
right,
is not going to be found deficient and a failing school because every year in the third grade these kids are not proficient in English.
Yeah, so on paper, it's going to look like a chronic problem when in reality it is not.
That's correct.
Yeah. I do not have an answer for you off the top of my head, but I will research it because I don't know.
Through the chair, this is not just this single school. I mean, there are schools that...
Good example,
that,
though.
It is a real good example because we have other school systems that are built, and I really think it comes down to a longer-term educational goal than the short educational yearly progress goals,
sure,
in the specific areas. And
sure,
so I would hope that we can get there, and I'll look forward to your communication.
Yeah, and one thing I'll comment, too, that, and we were talking at the break about, yeah, you've got a new commissioner coming in, and so that sort of leaves things in a little bit of flux, but there needs to be, and I know there's strong dialogue between the commissioner and governor and the Secretary of Education and Undersecretary Hickok, and to work through some of these problems. I'm not in those meetings, so I don't, and I'm not involved with that dialogue. A lot of these things are probably being addressed or worked through, hopefully to come up with a solution. And that I'm not aware of, but I know that there's, again, from my experience from being involved with some of the states and watching the process work, there is a tremendous willingness to address problems unique to the states and come up with logical solutions that still fall in the guidelines of NCLB. I don't know what they are right now for this example, but we've got some very bright people who work on these things, and so far we haven't been unable to address problems that in most states that most states have come up with. So that's sort of an overall statement. So I would encourage, Mr. Chairman, that there once your new commissioner gets in place, obviously, and I know you'll do this anyway, strong dialogue with your commissioner,
so that you have an understanding of what's going on, the communication that's taking place at that level, and I can also be a source of information and can dig things out from the department. So I think we can, you know, hopefully we can work through all these issues. But the main dialogue is taking place at that level, and again, I can be here to help support in terms of getting information and being that source for you at the legislative level.
Representative Capster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for indulging me. I have a couple of points and then two questions I want to ask. And again, I want to reiterate how unique Alaska is. You're going to get tired of hearing this, I'm sure, from all your states, but especially Alaska. But a lot of Western Alaska is likened, the Yupik culture is likened to the Navajo culture in terms of cultural strength. And it's really, in a lot of ways, like a foreign country. A lot of people who come out for the first time are really amazed at how much it is like a foreign country. And we get a lot of first-year teachers in my region. And you remember how exciting and challenging your first year in office was. I kind of liken that to being a first-year teacher. You have to deal with managing your classroom, dealing with parents, dealing with administration, managing your teacher aides, all of those things. And I imagine being a first-year teacher is very, very challenging, but to be doing that in a foreign culture is even more difficult. Most of our teachers, there are some cases where teachers fly to a village, look at what's before them, and get on the same plane that they flew there on. We have a lot of those stories that are told, and a lot of teachers don't last through the year, but most teachers don't last for their second year. And I just want to reiterate how concerned I am that you think that NCLB has one of the escape routes as whole new staffing for a school, because that's really not a remedy for a lot of places in Alaska. So my two questions are on the highly qualified teacher. A number of our schools, my dad was a teacher, I told you he taught in three small villages. In Platinum, he taught every grade, every subject. He was the only teacher. And I don't know how he would have been able to be highly qualified in every field. And I'm wondering how flexible NCLB is going to be and the federal government is going to be in terms of keeping a teacher like that.
I do not have, and I sound like a broken record, I don't have a specific answer for you on that because that is truly a unique situation. If these issues are being dealt with at the commissioner and secretary's level, I can find information, find out how they're being addressed in your plan, and hopefully provide you with the information. But I simply don't have an answer for you on that.
Okay, my second question, if I might, Mr. Chairman, and my last question is, where in the legislation does it allow for parental accountability? I know that NCLB requires districts and schools to have children proficient in English by grade 3. It requires that. And the parents have the power to remove the children from English proficiency classes, but the district is then held accountable. When does it become parental accountability and not district accountability?
That's strictly up to your plan.
Okay.
There's no guideline. I mean, there's no specific in NCLB.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three questions. They kind of overlap, but not really. First of all, I'd like to ask you, is your role here to just answer our questions, or is your role as you came here to answer our questions and then take back to Washington some of our challenges that are totally unique from other areas?
Oh, it is both.
Both?
Yes, and I will carry your concerns back, rest assured of that. That's one of my role is working at the legislative level, which is different than working at the commissioner's level, because, again, that communication is taking place with the secretary. So my role is to be a conduit of information both ways.
Thank you for that. And I want to follow up with two other questions. Are you going to be able to take enough time to go out into some of these areas so that you can really get a good idea of what for us right here in the Capitol, we don't have an idea at all what it's like in some of these areas. And even if we left today and said most states, they can leave the Capitol and that day get to almost every place they want to. Here, even if we left early this morning, there are some of these schools we wouldn't be able to get to in 2 days if we flew because of connections and everything like that. So I hope that you have an opportunity to do that, because I don't think you can get a real feel of what our challenges are in this state because of our vast expanse and how some of these areas are in just little tucked away places.
Yeah, Representative Capster and I were talking about that earlier. I would like to be able to come back and do that, because it would be helpful.
I think it would be real helpful.
I'm a government employee, so it does require approval. But if you could request that, then I might be able to work it out.
I would like us to be able to request that, Mr. Chairman. And the third question is, I hear you when you're saying that you've increased the funding through the No Child Left Behind program, and it sounds so good to me on the surface. If we could meet our challenges that we have, it would be wonderful. But when I look through, I've got some data here that what state funding was in 2001 and 2002 and what the change is going to be now that this is going to be in place. And I'm very concerned because sometimes, like in the past, class size reduction was like 7.6 million, and now that category is zero. Or the Eisenhower Professional Development State Grants was 2.3 million, and now it's zero. Or the IDEA Special Ed Funds was 21 million, and now it's down to 3 million. I'm concerned that there's just the planting going on, and if that is indeed the case, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to even, if money's taken away from other programs and now we're expected to do this, but we aren't being funded in other areas, it's really very little increase. So I'm very concerned about that. I know the intentions are good, but if we're not getting the funding that we got before plus this, we're in trouble. We're in deep trouble.
Well, to answer that, yeah, it would appear on paper that some of those monies in specific funds are not there, but in reality they are. It comes under your state plan and how you structure that money. I mean, the money is still there. It's just got it's got to be included in the overall plan. And some of those monies, again, you've got a lot of flexibility to move them around, which you didn't have before. And so it's just identified and labeled differently. Again, this is where the communication, but at the top level, between the commissioner and the secretary, in terms of the plan, that should all be addressed there.
Last follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Well, that's exactly what I'm getting at, because if we still get the amount of money, but it's not in those areas, then what do? We drop those programs and just forget them because now we're dealing with something else? I mean, to make us school overall efficient.
You make that decision. If it's in it's in your state plan how that money is spent.
Well, I understand that. I understand that now we have to decide how we're going to run our schools. We're not going to have very much more money, but we're being held accountable in a lot of other ways that we haven't been before. And in this area here, I'm just looking at good teachers make lifelong differences. And it says that you're going to provide 35% increase in federal funds. And then one of the categories says to improve teacher training, reduce class size, and increase teacher pay. Well, if we took the full 35% and spread it to increase teacher pay, it's not going to increase hardly, just very little of what that is. So what I'm saying is, I guess, that there's a lot of this that sounds good that we're going to have to deal with and we're going to be held accountable with, but in the long run, the money's not going to be making that much of a change. And I realize that a lot of this change isn't just we're talking about money, but we have to look at the reality at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously money is a very important part of it, and once I keep referring back to the plan, once your plan is in place or once it's been approved, then a lot of these answers will be there. I mean, the answers just simply aren't there right now because we're going through the process in terms of how much money is going to be where and how and where it can be spent. And there's simply not an answer for it today because that's part of this whole process.
Thank you. Just one question on money. It probably looks from Washington lots of times that the money that comes up here, we must use it for fuel. Go through us fairly quickly. But you look around this table and in this room, and we look like a fairly homogenous group. But we are not. And as I was looking, I was thinking that, you know, we have Representative Sisson and Representative Guerra. They're both from the city of Anchorage, and yet they're both from very special districts. Well, you might find that could be true in many places. But the entire state has about, rough numbers, 600,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Their community has about 300,000. Representative Kapschner lives on the Yukon River in a village. It's a large village, but it's still a village on the Yukon River. It's a long way from here. Think of the enormous changes that we have from one individual to another. And around the table, I mean, we're all from very widely dispersed places. My own borough is bigger than West Virginia. It's just a borough with 30, 40, 50,000 people. And so we have these difficulties, but we have to face that when we get certain amounts of money, especially if you're asking a teacher to go to the village, and if they get off that plane and say, well, where am I living? And you show them, they may not want to stay because it's marginal housing. And we have kids in portables, many portables. So we do face the enormous, you know, there are economies of scale, and we are the inverse of that. Our scales are just too big. And so for us to even go home, it's a fortune and money to send any of us home, and to send any of us to Washington is... the amount of money to take a whole family on vacation for a week, probably. So there are a lot of things we can't do. And so even though it may look like money gets sent to Alaska and where does it go, I think I could probably tell you how difficult it is to get and retain people, how difficult it is to travel between the communities, how difficult it is to just buy a market basket full of groceries at a price that would simply make your jaw drop. And how difficult it is to do a lot of things. We need more money than it would look to someone who is just looking from a long distance away. Thank you. And Representative Coghill was next.
Thank you. Need more money. I've heard that one before.
Want
more. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, resources are always going to be an issue when it comes to education delivery. But first of all, thanks for coming to Alaska, Mr. Meyer. I appreciate that. We heard the state give us some of the working points with this issue just the other day in a joint committee, and I really appreciated that as well. First of all, let me just say, I think historically this legislature has been in agreement with what this focus is, the accountability for students, trying to raise the level of education and be able to measure that. Focusing on what works is obviously a discussion that, as you can see around this table, we're trying to figure that out, whether it's accountability for a school, a district, or a state. And we've laid in some good fixes, I think, within the state law, which are not going to be coming from the same bases that this No Child Left Behind law brings. So I think, although we're in agreement in so many of the areas, how do we get there technically and still take care of our educational needs? I applaud the parental choice in the matter. We've tried to accommodate that through the variety of areas like distance learning and trying to supply educational needs to those who have these very unique circumstances that we have all over Alaska, including cultural differences. So for that, I'm grateful. some of the areas that the state brought before us that we might end up having to legislate are going to be, since we have designated schools and now it looks like we're going to have to designate districts, how are we going to do that? And some of the discussion here falls very heavily on that. For example, Representative Kapsner has probably not only schools problem, but district problem, and how do we get good education? How do we get the teachers the right kind of pay? How do we even induce them to come to this great state and teach in our schools? So those are some of the issues we're going to be dealing with, and I think you've heard quite a range of issues here. The only thing that I guess I would say for you to take back is that I know our department has asked for flexibility, and I can see where that's going to be needed because we have two different gearboxes going at different rates of speed here, mm-hmm. both trying to go the same direction. And I think we need to have that accountability, and I applaud the President, Secretary Page, and all the work that's come down on it. But at the same time, since we have already started down that road and have now a 10-year history of laying in laws and actually creating accountability factors, I would, at that point, plead for some flexibility because when we have to discuss these and put them actually into the rule book, how we govern ourselves, we want to stay in that same direction of accountability. Certainly we want to have teachers here that are highly qualified, but we feel that that qualification can be a real stumbling block for us. And so that flexibility, I think, is important. And then we have school designators, whereas you'll have district remedies. And some of the remedies I don't think fit very well. And you've heard that here. I don't have to reiterate them all, but the remedies, I think, need to be flexible enough for a state plan to incorporate. So I would just plead for flexibility there. And without getting into all the nuts and bolts of it, those are some of the key areas. Certainly the money, the only thing that I would say that I feel that gets pretty close to an unfunded mandate is a special education. And I think that component needs to be looked at closely as we go down through this because we do have unique circumstances where high-cost idea education is difficult to install, and it's certainly hard to get people there for them.
Just logistically.
Right. Yeah. So just those are some of the, I think, key areas that, as we heard from the state, they used some words that I found kind of interesting, compensatory versus conjunctive systems. And going in the same direction, it's just that they have different gear ratios. So how do we measure achievement, and at what point do we get penalized if we are, in fact, achieving? I think that's going to be an important part of the discussion. I was listening as carefully as I could on how we were going to get there. I still don't know necessarily all the details yet, but obviously if we get kicked out and we're making progress, I think that would be most unfortunate.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that
at all. So just generally, I agree with the program. I applaud it. I look forward to working with it. But I think if we're going to get these gears to get into the same gearbox, we're going to have to work at that, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Cockhill. Let the record show that Representative Dahlstrom has joined us probably about 10 minutes ago at our table. Next to speak, Representative Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a comment and a quick question. Please remember that this Alaska is not this Alaska. And there's a huge, huge difference. Where in people's minds, you know, here, we're this.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, if you could see the terrain and what we're all trying to describe to you. So I'm looking forward to you coming back and seeing for yourself. But the question I have, it seems that the cornerstone to a lot of this is the teachers. And yet we're facing a shortage. Is the federal government or in this plan doing anything to promote or attract more teachers in the future?
Other than providing more funding for teacher training, and which can be used for various things, training bonuses, give you some flexibility from that standpoint. But no, I mean, from a federal standpoint, there's nothing. It's still a state function to attract teachers.
with the recognition that, yeah, funding is a critical part of that. There has been increased funding for that effort. Is it enough? I don't know, to be honest. I mean, obviously, again, you truly do have some very unique challenges logistically and distance and that kind of thing, and these issues need to be addressed. And at the commissioner's level again, in the plan and.
Well, speaking more is to the national shortage of teachers, are you doing anything? Is there anything on the horizon to try to stimulate more kids going into the teaching field nationally?
There's not a specific national program per se. There is the fundamental nature of No Child Left Behind and the flexibility that's built into it. Is providing, we're seeing, for instance, more foundations, and I mentioned earlier, corporate sponsors and that kind of thing, getting actively involved with providing more funding for teacher training, with actually setting up, you know, foundations that are paying for kids to go into education. We're seeing more of that type of thing. No, there's not a federal program, but we're seeing, because of the accountability measures that are built into it and the cultural shift in education in general, that we're seeing more activity from the private sector to help do that.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra and then Representative Cisna.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The questions I have now are follow-ups on the questions I asked at the beginning. During break, I received some information from people in the audience, and the information they've been given seems to be different than the information people have given you, and I'm wondering which one of us is wrong. So here are the questions. Overall, here's my concern. Law has as part of its mandate that we do a lot more in the way of assessing and a lot more in the way of testing.
Right.
And my fear is that in order to fund for that national mandate, we're going to have bigger class sizes to pay for it, because we're going to lose money in our classrooms in order to pay for the bureaucratic part of that. Here are the questions, and I'm hoping you're going to tell me I'm wrong. The first is on the question of the assessments that this law requires the schools to do.
Mm-hmm.
I would have no problem with the assessments if the federal government were going to provide us with the money to conduct those assessments. Assessing school progress is a good thing. However, if the choice is given to the states to either spend its money on hiring more teachers or doing more assessments, that becomes a much more difficult problem. The understanding of some in the audience is different than the understanding that people have shared with you, and this is what I want to find out. The understanding of some of the folks in the audience is that federal money will come to the state to set up these new assessment programs. But then from then on in the future, as we're required to perform these assessments, we will not receive federal money to pay for the assessment program. We'll receive federal money to set the program up, but not continuing federal money to engage in the assessments. So if that's the case, then it is an unfunded mandate. If that's the case, then it is requiring us to take money away from things that we think works and put money towards things that the federal government thinks work.
Uh-huh.
Is their understanding correct on that point?
I will find out.
The other question is a follow-up to a question that Representative Wilson asked, and that has to do with small class sizes. A few of us have talked about that today. One of the things we've decided in this state that works is attempts on a statewide basis, and actually with federal help in the past, to reduce the class sizes in classrooms. And there was a Department of Education study that came out not too long ago that talked about class sizes of 18 and less being wonderful for kids, and class sizes of larger than that not being all that beneficial for kids in the lower grades. That was the Department of Education's opinion, at least as of a half dozen years ago. According to some statistics I have, last year this state under the federal small class size reduction grant received about $7.6 million to help us reduce class sizes. That money is going to disappear under the SNOW program. But what we're getting instead is what I understand to be roughly an equivalent amount of money to be made in a Title V grant that would allow this state the flexibility to use that money for any projects that we deem beneficial to students. So as I see it, we're losing $7.6 million a year that used to go to help us reduce class sizes, and now we're getting an equivalent amount of money, roughly, for us to use for reducing class sizes and a number of other things. So what seems to be a net loss in money available to help us reduce our class sizes. Am I missing something? Is there at least the equivalent of $7.6 million, or is there at least the equivalent of what we received before this act came into effect that exists now to help us reduce class sizes, or not? And in asking that question, there's a certain amount of this flexible money we've talked about. I guess I'm interested in knowing, besides that, are there any other No Child Left Behind programs that are providing us money that we can use to reduce class sizes? I'm looking for the world of money that is going to come to the state that will allow us to reduce class sizes. But my understanding right now is that it's a wash, but really less than a wash, because the money that used to be directed at small class sizes is now directed at a lot of things, including reducing small class sizes. And I hope I'm wrong, because I think in that case it leaves us in a worse place than we were before the act took effect.
Funding is one issue. Well, I understand what you're saying. The concept of NCLB is to provide the funding, and I don't know the dollar amount, so I can't speak to that. But let's assume it's as much or more. But it may not be earmarked for class size reduction, but you do have the flexibility to do that if you would want to. Again, there's the whole concept here is to provide more flexibility for the money that's being spent. And that's sort of a generic statement. I do not know what the dollar amount is for Alaska, and that's something that I'll just have to find out on that specific.
Just one follow-up question, if I can, Mr. Chair. And that is, has there been a shift within the Department of Education from the view that reducing class sizes is a priority to a view today that it's not, or is it just as much a priority as it has been under prior administrations?
The shift is to provide local control and make that call at the local level or state or local level. I don't know that there's a fundamental shift from the department standpoint. Officially, again, I'll have to just find out about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Sisna?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hate to do this, but I kind of want to go back to the beginning and to the No Child Left Behind. No child, not one single kid that we could pick off the street, left behind. Alaska leads the nation in all alcoholism. Really sure of that. We're right at the top. And not surprisingly then, we are among the top, and I'm not sure where, I think it's right at the top, but it's somewhere near the top in fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effects. So you wind up with more children on that street that we're going to put one child out of that might possibly be that child with either fetal alcohol effect or syndrome. And dependent upon exactly how it's played out in their brain, it's going to mean that they can't read or they can read, or a whole bunch of ways that their hardware is completely different than most of the people in this room, probably, right? No child left behind. How far behind what level, what is, oh, standard, okay, it's a standard. Standard says to me, kind of average, is that, I don't remember all my courses that I took that were supposed to teach me that, and I took them several times, that tells you, but and I don't have fetal alcohol affected.
Yes, I remember everything.
Anyway, it's those kids will never get up to that standard because they are one of the early generations. They're back to, we're an early generation of